Grad student workers at the University of Illinois in Urbana went on strike 10 days ago. They want better pay, better benefits, and a guarantee that they'll all receive what's known as a tuition waiver. Here's union co-president Gus Wood.
If we can't guarantee tuition waivers for those people coming up behind us, then you're going to see the collapse of higher education because nobody's going to be able to afford it. Nobody's going to go to graduate school anymore. That's what's at stake today.
We'll hear from Gus and from the U of I administration with Vice Provost Bill Bernhard.
It's really about the faculty deciding how are they going to deal with those budget constraints that we see that are very real for us.
Plus, baseball's spring training is underway, so do the Cubs look like they're ready for a new season? We'll get an update from WBEZ's Cheryl Ray Stout. And our series of interviews with the Democratic candidates for Illinois' 13th Congressional District continues today with John Ebel and Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. Today marks 10 days since nearly 2,700 grad student workers at the University of Illinois officially went on strike. Hundreds of classes have since been canceled and dozens more have been moved. And on Tuesday, demonstrators began occupying the office of U of I President Tim Killeen. Yesterday, however, the union and university administrators took steps toward a possible agreement. They spent most of the day in contract negotiations, and both sides told Champaign's News Gazette that progress had indeed been made. Those negotiations have continued through this morning. The group that represents these workers at the U of I is called the Graduate Employees Organization, or GEO. They not only pursue advanced degrees and research at the university, but they also work as teaching assistants, and they've not had a contract since their last one expired in August. We'll hear from the GEO's co-president, along with the University of Illinois' vice provost, in a minute. But first, we're joined by Lee Gaines, education reporter with the Journalism Collaborative Illinois Newsroom. She's based here in Urbana at WILL. She's actually in Chicago now and joins us on the phone. Lee, welcome back to the 21st.
Glad to be here.
Lee, you've been covering these events leading up to this strike, and it had been building for weeks, and now the strike itself. Can you just kind of walk us through the events that led to this formal strike by the GEO that began last week?
Sure. So the two sides have been bargaining for about a year. I think they officially started bargaining on March 30th of last year, and then the GEO's contract expired in mid-August. And since the fall, they've been bargaining with a federal mediator involved in those negotiations. And the GEO, I believe, pulled its membership in fall of last year about a strike. And then in January of this year, it became increasingly clear to me, because that's kind of when I started covering it, that the strike was where things appeared to be headed. There were numerous rallies. There continue to be numerous rallies during the strike. And then in February, early February, they announced their intent to strike, and that's where we are now. We are obviously well into the second week of that strike.
What's at the heart of this disagreement between the GEO and U of I administration?
So there are really two big issues for the GEO, which is they're asking for numerous things, but the two biggest ones are wages and tuition waivers. So a lot of GEO members are making pretty low wages compared to what people would make in the private sector. I believe the lowest paid person is somewhere around $16,000 a year. So they want a wage increase for their membership. But tuition waivers, I think it should be noted, are really the base of the discussion here, because without a tuition waiver, the wage increases don't really make a difference.
Now, there's a series of goals that the GEO has, and they all point back to what they see as fair compensation. Some of those probably seem like common sense to most listeners. For example, higher wages and more resources for benefits like child care. But let's zoom in on the one unique element of this that people who don't work at universities might not know about. It is the issue of tuition waivers. Can you explain briefly what is a tuition waiver?
So it's kind of like what it sounds. It's a situation where you're not paying tuition. A full tuition waiver would be you're not paying tuition. There's some fees associated with attending the university that might be waived as well. And I think it should be noted that waivers aren't just given to graduate employees. They're also given to other employees of the university, kind of like an employment perk. But in this case, yeah, the GEO basically wants full tuition waivers for all current and future union members with either a graduate or a teaching assistant job at the university.
And what's the university's position on tuition waivers?
So what the administration has said is, like, look, we get it. We get that tuition waivers are important. We understand that you are not making a lot of money here and that the having to pay tuition would be really burdensome for you. And it would also lock a lot of people without a lot of money out of the higher education system. So what the university has proposed is, look, you know, anyone who currently has a tuition waiver, don't worry, we're not going to mess with it. But what they want is more control over who gets a waiver in the future. So what Bill Bernhard told me, he's the vice provost, is that, you know, if you're a PhD student, it's basically a given that you're going to get a waiver. No one expects you to pay tuition for 4, 5, 6 years while you're here. But there are some master's degree programs at the university that are supposed to be what he calls revenue generating. So they're supposed to be programs in which a student applies, enrolls, and pays tuition for 1 or 2 years. And it's really important, he says, for the sustainability of those programs to get that tuition. And what's been happening, or what could happen under the language of the prior GEO contract, is that someone in one of those revenue generating departments could get a GA or a TA in another department, and then their tuition is automatically waived per the GEO contract. So from my understanding, the university administration wants to prevent that from happening so that these particular master's degree programs get the tuition that they're expecting.
And Lee, can you give us a sense of the scale of this strike? There are about 2,700 members of the GEO, and what effect has the strike had on day-to-day life here at the University of Illinois?
I think it's had a significant effect. We've been getting some strike numbers from the university. We haven't gotten any this week, but we got some last week. And, you know, according to the university's figures, about 600 people were striking last week, and more than 450 classes were canceled, and then more than 200 classes were moved. And so that's, you know, that's not a huge percentage of classes at the university. I think there's something like 2,000 and change classes happening any given day, but it's still significant, you know, and I've heard from at least one undergraduate that the noise that the picketers are making can be really disruptive. And I think that the 600 people striking doesn't really fully take into account the number of people that are actually out there on any given day rallying. The first day of the strike was pretty incredible to watch. I think there was, like, you know, by my rough estimate, 1,000 people on the quad. It was pretty incredible to see.
And Lee, we'll hear from a member of the GEO in just a bit, along with the vice provost of the U of I, Bill Bernhard, who you referenced a bit earlier. You know, they'll explain each of their points of view. But what do you think listeners should keep in mind as they're hearing both of these perspectives?
I think they should keep in mind that this is actually a really complex issue. It's not black and white. The university and the GEO's position is essentially that they want full tuition waivers for all of their graduate members. And I believe the administration's position is, as I explained, a little bit more nuanced. You know, it's like they're not against tuition waivers, but they do want more control over who gets them. And I think that there's a sense of mistrust that's been sown throughout these negotiations where the graduate employees that I talk to, They just don't believe that the administration has heard them, and I think they're having a hard time trusting that the administration doesn't just want to use this as a tool to eventually get rid of waivers altogether.
Very good. Lee Gaines, education reporter for the Illinois Newsroom. She's been reporting on this issue, and we'll come back to Lee in just a few minutes. And of course, I want to mention that there has been some progress made in negotiations yesterday and today. We'll get some perspective on that here in just a moment. Let's welcome in now Marilia Cajea. She's the co-president of the Graduate Employees Organization. Marilia, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Before we get to the issues at play in the strike and the negotiations, we spoke about tuition waivers earlier. You're a grad student. I wanted to ask you first, do you have a tuition waiver?
I do. I'm now on fellowship, though, so I'm not a graduate employee this year, but I've been for a couple of years. I taught for 4 semesters.
And what has the tuition waiver meant for you?
It meant everything. I would not be able to be here if I didn't have a tuition waiver. I come from Brazil, actually, and, my family is not wealthy, so I would never be able to be here if I didn't have, if I had to pay $27,000 as an out-of-state student. So if I didn't have the tuition waiver, I would not be here.
Why is it important to you and the GEO that tuition waivers be guaranteed for all teaching assistant and graduate workers in your contract?
So the university, the administration, our professors, everyone that we hear from that is the university, they always tell us how much they value diversity, how much they value that, you know, they are able to bring the brightest minds of the entire world to be here and conduct research and teach their students. So I think that's important that they you know, that they really show us that, you know, as employees. So if we're working for them, our bargaining unit is TAs and GAs. So what we're asking is that all TAs and GAs, everyone that works for them, that teaches the classes at the University of Illinois that are graduate students, that they get the tuition waivers. Because as you were just saying earlier, our wages here, the minimum wage is a little over $16,000 a year. And we would be deeply in debt if we'd have to teach these classes without a tuition waiver. And of course, a bunch of us would not be able to go into this debt and would not be here. So we believe that the university would go back to only having wealthy people who study here and conduct research. So we would go back 100 years, basically. This.
What other goals related to compensation are you hoping to achieve?
Compensation for TAs and GAs with this contract?
Yes.
So we are focusing on financial stability. I think that the bargaining team is working on something in different proposals to actually give us financial stability. We're not necessarily, and I can't tell you much about this because I am not on the bargaining team myself, but that's basically our issue. We want our members, TAs and GAs, to be able to pay their bills, eat, and have a, you know, stable life while they do the work as of teachers at the University of Illinois.
As you know, the University of Illinois is a big institution. There are alumni all over the state and many people throughout Illinois who are connected to it in some way. You know, there might be some people listening who are thinking that the strike is hurting current undergraduate students by disrupting their regular schedule of classes. Mm-hmm. What would you say in response to that?
I'd say that they you know, I'd ask them to call the provost and actually tell them to give us our contract. We have been working without this contract for more than 205 days, and that we are the people who teach their kids, their children. So if they really want their kids to have a good education, that this is also, you know, something that they should be worried about, that everyone who's teaching their students, who is teaching their children, receive good compensation, that the you know, and this is also not only our fight, it's also, you know, non-tenured faculty, graduate employees, staff, in order for their children to be living in a good environment. The people around them, the people that deal with them in an everyday basis, they need to be well compensated.
I'm talking with Marilia Cojea, the co-president of the Graduate Employees Organization, about the current strike on the University of Illinois Urbana campus. Marilia, on Tuesday, demonstrators began occupying the office of U of I President Tim Killeen. Why did you decide to do that?
I am actually not one of the occupiers, so I wouldn't be able to tell you much about that. I think they are the people to talk to, but I think this comes from, you know, our frustration that the president, the provost, the chancellor, none of them have been to one bargaining session. The provost that was before, it was an interim provost before Andreas Cangelaris came to be the provost. He went to one bargaining session, but the new provost has never been to one. So that came from, you know, from our stand that if you won't come to the bargaining session, we'll come to you and we'll, you know, as an our attempt to talk to them and be heard, because yes, we think that they're not hearing us.
We need to take a break here in just a minute, but one more question before we do. As our reporter Lee Gaines brought up earlier, one critical disagreement here relates to whether the administration should be able to review whether certain grad students can get tuition waivers, especially those who are in certain master's programs that generate revenue for the university. I think MBA students might be a prime example of that. What would you say to the idea that public universities are cash-strapped or short of money and that the school needs control over tuition waivers so those departments can get the money that they need?
The GO contract does not prevent the administration or departments from creating new programs. Our only issue is that the people who do the work deserve the compensation. So if someone does the work as a TA or a GA, they need to get the tuition waivers. But we see in the last 10 years, a lot of these new self-supporting programs being created. And our contract does not prevent them from doing that. So that's what I have to say about that.
Just one quick question before our break. Can I ask you, the teaching assistants who are on strike, are they really missing out on their pay right now?
I can't tell you that right now because me particularly, I'm not teaching, and I have not heard from people if they are having their pay docked. So maybe after the strike is over, we will hear more about that because the departments need to do that.
All right. Marilia Cohea, co-president of the Graduate Employees Organization at the University of Illinois. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And stay tuned. Coming up on the 21st after the break, we'll hear from Bill Bernhardt, Vice Provost for Academic Affairs at the University of Illinois, for the administration's perspective on this discussion. Thanks for joining us. We are on the 21st here. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. We're talking about the strike on the University of Illinois campus by the Graduate Employees Organization, and we've been speaking with Marilia Cohea, the co-president of the Graduate Employees Organization. One more question for you, Marilia, before we let you go. But we've mentioned that there were negotiations that started yesterday that have gone all night and into this morning. From what you're hearing, I know you're not on the bargaining team, but from what you're hearing from members of the GEO, are you optimistic that an agreement will be reached soon?
Well, I'm always optimistic. We've been doing this for 11 days now out on this strike. And I can just say that I really hope we can reach an agreement today. I have not heard from the bargaining team yet, but they've been there for now almost 28 hours, I think. So I think this is a good sign. I think they have been making progress. I hope they have been making progress.
Okay, and we may bring you back in here in just a minute, Marilia, but let's bring in Bill Bernhardt, the Vice Provost for Academic Affairs at the University of Illinois. Bill, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian.
I guess I'll just ask you what I just asked Marilia. Based on what you're hearing from folks in the bargaining session, are you optimistic that we'll get to an agreement?
Well, I share her position that we're always optimistic, and the fact that the bargaining teams have been together now for over a day, and there's a good communication back and forth, that all signs point to that there'll be some movement at least, and we're very, very happy and hope that it comes to a quick resolution.
Let's delve into some of the issues here, Bill. We talked about tuition waivers being a critical part of what's being discussed. I'm assuming you agree with that. Tuition waivers are a very important part of what we're discussing here.
Right. I think tuition waivers are one of the central issues here in the strike. And I think, tuition waivers, when we look at it, really is a foundational element to graduate education in the United States and here at the University of Illinois. It's so important to be able to have our graduate students have the ability to have these their tuition taken care of, so they can focus on their studies and so that they can train, learn what it takes to be a professional academic. I think the key issues here, as we see them, you know, on the one hand, we very much recognize that when a student comes into our program, a program expecting a tuition waiver, they should not have the terms of that program changed behind them. That would be horrible. That's not fair to them. It's not appropriate. And we certainly want to make sure that those students are protected, that when they enter the program with certain expectations, those expectations are met. I think another broader issue here that we hear from the GEO and many of our faculty is a concern that, what the administration has been putting forward would be a backdoor into creating a university without tuition waivers, a university that wasn't as accessible, a university that did not support graduate education. And I think we hear those concerns. We understand those concerns. As a former graduate student myself, and as someone who came to this institution as a faculty member, precisely because I would have the opportunity to work with graduate students, we want to find ways to make sure to provide assurances to the GEO and to our graduate student community that tuition waivers are not going away. They will continue to be an important part of graduate education at Illinois. They will continue to provide the types of support necessary for us to attract the smartest, most hardworking, most talented graduate students in the world. At the same time, we also face, as you mentioned, some physical constraints. And I think we need to think about how we can make sure that we are being flexible and we are exploring different ways of approaching graduate education. Not necessarily for people who are doing providing assistantships. Those are going to stay there. But we want to make sure that the faculty have the opportunity to think about designing programs, designating programs that are appropriate to their disciplines, that are appropriate to their departments, that are appropriate to the types of student demands that they're seeing. Many departments will continue to operate in the traditional mode of tuition waivers for assistantships. But there are some departments in some areas that would like to explore different ways of pursuing master's programs that require tuition and things like that. So, we want to find language that and find a way that makes sure that provides these assurances the foundational elements of graduate education will continue here, and we're embracing that. And at the same time, we want to make sure that our faculty, who are closest to the ground there, who have the responsibility for thinking about how best to provide different educational opportunities, that the faculty still have the ability and the flexibility to respond and change their programs.
I'm wondering if you can maybe give me an example where if the university were to guarantee tuition waivers for all graduate employees, what's a scenario in your view where that could put the school in a difficult position? What's an example?
Well, I think, again, it's... this is the way we've always done business. So in some sense, we're not, it's not a change, but the way our previous agreements have been interpreted do create some potential barriers for departments changing the way they want to conduct their programs. Some of those challenges may come in, changing the waiver designation for a program, or sometimes in some circumstances, the ability to think about creating a new program that would require tuition waivers. We understand, we understand those concerns. We understand that we want to provide those assurances, but we also want to make sure that, the faculty have the final say to design the programs in a way that is going to be most beneficial to their overall educational objectives.
How does the state's financial situation play a role in all of this, Bill? Certainly we had a budget crisis that lasted more than 2 years, and in general the state of Illinois is really not in a good fiscal position. Does that make it a little bit more difficult from the university side of things?
I think it makes it more difficult from everybody's side of things. Certainly the budget difficulties provide a very difficult backdrop to this type of conversation. and creates a lot of uncertainty for folks out there, particularly our graduate student colleagues who are, quite frankly, vulnerable members of our community. Anytime you hear about decreasing resources, you wonder what the future holds. And we recognize that it creates some uncertainties for them, and we want to be responsive to that. At the same time, that budget uncertainty creates the need for our university to think about how to respond. How can we increase our financial autonomy? How can we increase revenues? How can we be sure that we are have enough resources to provide the type of education, the type of scholarship, the type of engagement that's been a hallmark of our institution for 150 years now.
And a little breaking news to report. The GEO has just tweeted that the bargaining team has signed a tentative agreement with the administration, which will now go to the administration for ratification. Pickets for today have been suspended. If the members vote to ratify, the strike is over and we have a new contract. If not, the strike continues. It then that goes on to say that all members should go to the Independent Media Center in Urbana at 4 p.m. for a vote. That's all GEO members. So again, that's breaking news, a tentative agreement with the administration and the GEO. I'd like to get reaction from both of you on that. First, Marilia, your thoughts on hearing that news.
Well, I'm really happy about it. we still need to vote on it as a with our membership. So I haven't read that proposal yet, but I trust our bargaining team. If they think it's worth it calling a GEO general membership meeting, I'm really happy about it, and I think that we can close this chapter in the GEO's history.
Bill, your thoughts on that news?
Well, also I would agree that it's terrific news, and we're very pleased that we've reached this stage, and want to congratulate the bargaining team for both bargaining teams from both sides on working so hard and so diligently over the past 28 hours to pull together some language and find the common ground between the GEO and the university.
Bill Bernhard, Vice Provost for Academic Affairs at the University. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Marilia Cohea, Co-President of the GEO. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. The preseason in any pro sports league is usually reserved for diehard fans, but in Major League Baseball, spring training is an excuse to watch baseball in the parts of the country where it's actually warm in March. It also offers a preview of the season ahead, which starts next month. Of course, for the Cubs last season, it did not go quite as well as 2016 when they broke their curse and won the World Series. Instead, the 2017 season ended like this.
Line shot, and it is caught, and the ball game is over, and the Los Angeles Dodgers have won the pennant. The Dodgers are headed to the World Series.
That's Brian Anderson from TBS. So will the Cubs bounce back, and how's it looking for the rest of the league in general? Joining me now is WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Ray Stout. Cheryl, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Brian.
Let's start by talking about those Cubs. Obviously, last year at this time, we were still on a high from the World Series win, but going back-to-back didn't pan out, and they lost to those Dodgers in the playoffs. Are the Cubs a title contender this year?
Absolutely. I think they had a lot of the World Series hangover last year. There was also the issue at leadoff spot when Joe Maddon decided to put Kyle Schwarber in that spot, and it didn't work out. He ended up going to the minor leagues. This spring, there's a different feeling about the club. Ian Happ is having a wonderful spring training so far. He is leading off. He's got four home runs in that spot. He's a switch hitter. He gets on base. So if Joe Maddon settles in on him, that settles a problem that he had when they let Dexter Fowler go. And their pitching staff has been improved again. Yu Darvish signed with them. They also signed Tyler Chatwood, who was going today on the mound. They did lose Jake Arrieta, who is still a free agent.
Yeah, you mentioned Yu Darvish being the biggest free agent signing of the offseason. How has he looked so far?
He's only had one start because he had a stomach virus, and he did strike out four batters. So they take the starters in a very slow, progressive way of getting on track because they don't want to stretch him out too early, but do want to give him a stretch out. So he'll have another start in the next couple of days.
What do you think the Cubs might have learned from their playoff loss to the Dodgers last season?
One thing they learned is they got to have more run production. Secondly, they had to learn that it isn't easy to get back there again and to not rest on your laurels. And thirdly, they just had a learning process. It's just not easy to repeat. They didn't have major injuries, but they had some injuries along the way, and their starting pitchers, you know, seemed to be fatigued from the previous year, and that's the problem. Joe Maddon knew that the problem when you have pitchers going deep, the problem when you have pitchers that have gone into postseason, it's a lot of wear and tear in them, and they are your bread and butter.
We need to make one of our producers happy, Steve Mork. Let's talk a little Chicago White Sox here, Cheryl. they had a pretty tough season last year, at least in terms of results on the field. Are they looking to improve this year?
They're going to be fun to watch. This year two of the rebuild, watch spring training right now. Like today, they got Michael Kopech on the mound. You've got players that are not going to be with the major league roster right away, but they'll be coming in, you know, dribs and drabs throughout the season. You're going to have full season of Lucas Giolito, full seasons of Ronaldo Lopez. You know, you have a lot of these players, Johan Moncada, full seasons of them. They're going to produce. Expect some bumps in the road because they've never played full seasons of MLB, Major League Baseball. However, they should have improvements. I've been around this club a lot. They really enjoy each other. Ricky Renteria is a teacher and a developer. So this team should be really good next year for sure. Improvements this year. Watch in the minor leagues for Luis Robert, who had a grand slam yesterday, and also Eloy Jimenez, who is their top prospect. He does have some knee soreness. He should be up in the big leagues probably the end of this year or next year. And Tim Anderson, watch him have a bounce back year. He had a down year last year. He went through a personal struggle. So this team has a lot of good elements. I just don't know how good they're going to be the whole season, but we're going to see some fun, exciting baseball.
That maybe sounds like the Cubs from maybe about 2014 or so. Is that mm-hmm. a pretty good parallel?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, one of their starters won't even be in the rotation until June. That's Carlos Rodon, who has a shoulder surgery. So they're very, very similar. The White Sox had a little more prospects that they were able to get because of being able to trade Adam Eaton last year and also Chris Sale. So they were able to rebuild a little bit quicker than the Cubs did, but they're on a similar path.
Of course, looking at the broad baseball season here as well, what are some of the big storylines and questions you're looking at across the league? We have about 90 seconds here, Cheryl.
One is watching Ichiro sign back with Seattle, watching him be now 44 years old. And the other one is watching his countrymates, Shohei Ohtani with the Angels, to see if he can transfer to the United States, be able to play as a pitcher and as a hitter. That's what he wants to do. Watch out for the Yankees. They have they've got quite firepower. And also, it's going to be interesting to watch Davey Martinez taking over the Washington Nationals to see if they could get beyond a first-round playoff berth.
And 60 seconds left here, Cheryl. Do you think the Astros can repeat this year?
Absolutely. They have done some incredible work they have a great farm system. They've added to their arsenal. They really have all the elements from top to bottom. They're a team that just they know how to win, and if they don't have the hangover like the Cubs did, they should be pretty well stocked for the end of the year.
WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Ray Stout. Cheryl, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Brian.
Stay with us. Coming up on the 21st, we'll continue our series of interviews with candidates in the 13th Congressional District. That's coming up next here on the 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, presenting The Aesthetics of Collective Experience, March 9th at 4 p.m. at Spurlock Museum. Artist Amanda Browder will discuss her public art project, Chromatopia, and giving voice to a community with collaborative art practices. cas.illinois.edu.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. Illinois' 13th Congressional District is represented right now in Washington by Rodney Davis. He's not facing a primary challenger from his own party, but on the Democratic side, five people are vying to face off against him after the March 20th primary, and The 21st has recorded interviews with all of them. The district covers all or part of 14 different counties across central and southwestern Illinois, including Bloomington, Champaign, and Springfield. Today, we hear from John Ebel and Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. First, John Ebel is a religion professor at the University of Illinois. He's also had a past career in the military, serving for 11 years in the Navy as an intelligence officer. He spoke with Nyla Boodoo last week.
John Ebel, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Nyla.
So this is an election year where we've seen lots of Democrats stepping up for a variety of offices, whether it's for the gubernatorial race, for our attorney general. Last time around, there was just one opponent in the Democratic primary against Rodney Davis. Why are you running against him to represent the 13th district now?
Well, I can answer that question in a couple of different ways. I'm part of that blue wave that people have been talking about who I didn't wake up on November 9th. I got out of bed. I hadn't been able to sleep the night of the election in 2016. And I knew that I had to do something, that the world had changed, perhaps to say that it had changed isn't exactly right. But there was something about the world that I needed to try to fix. And I looked around at the things that I could do. And I feel very well represented at a lot of different levels, at the level of our state representative, Carol Ammons, State Senator Scott Bennett are doing a fantastic job. The one big problem that I see is our Congressman, Rodney Davis. And so I started talking with my wife and my daughters about whether this would be something that they were in for. It's a family decision when you run for office. And we decided that, yes, and it was important to them. It was important to me to try to make some sort of difference in the current political moment. Now, what it is that I see myself being able to bring to this office is the background of someone who has had military service. As you said, a total of 11 years, four of those were on active duty, seven in the reserves, which gives you sort of a lived experience of bipartisanship, which feels to me to be something that's fleeting right now, that in our current political moment, it's harder for people to see each other across the aisle, to see themselves in the person sitting across the aisle. And I did that for 11 years working in the military, where there were people working alongside me with whom I agreed on exactly nothing politically. But yet we had to get stuff done. And at the end of the day, we would even go and have dinner and have a beer. So I would like to bring that kind of spirit back to Congress to try to regenerate it, and also to put government back closer in touch with people. On both sides of the aisle, there are corporate interests and entrenched politicians who have lost sight of what it is that they're supposed to be doing. I won't be that sort of person. I want to really, truly represent this district.
You've said your first priority, if elected, would be towards infrastructure. Why, and what do you plan to do to achieve that?
Well, infrastructure is, it's not the sexiest topic, but it is something that there is bipartisan support for and that would benefit everyone. So I think that's actually a bill that we could get done, and its effects wouldn't be just to improve our roads. I mean, you've been driving around Champaign-Urbana the last couple of weeks. The potholes are pretty remarkable, and nobody loves a pothole. So improving the roads, improving bridges, extending broadband access to our rural communities. There are 200,000 people in our district who don't have access to broadband internet, and laying the groundwork for a green and renewable energy economy, all stuff that could be part of an infrastructure bill. And we need to hire people to do that work. So it has the effect effect of improving our infrastructure and improving our economy in the way that actually works, which is priming the pump. And there are a number of opportunities, I think, to get meaningful infrastructure legislation passed. I don't like the way that the Trump administration has proposed to approach it, which is to put the burden, 80% of the burden, on local communities. We're already stressed here in Champaign County, and I've seen it, I've heard it across the district. People are in a bad budget situation because of the state budget, and also because our tax revenue has been falling. So I think we need to ask the federal government to step up and bear a larger percentage of that cost.
We just have a few minutes left. I want to ask you a couple more questions. You've said repealing the ACA is morally wrong. How do you think we should solve the problem of affordable health care?
We need to pass expanded improved Medicare for all. We need to have a single-payer system in this country. It's long past the moment for us to have put that in place. We're all, Nyla, going to need to see a doctor at some point in our lives. That shouldn't be a privilege for those who have the money. It should be something that we can all count on. And it shouldn't be connected to employment. That's, for me, what really makes Medicare for All so important, is that when someone loses their job now, they're down and they get kicked because they lose their health care. That's just too much for many people to bear, and it's not the way that we should be structuring our approach to problems that we're all going to face.
Do you think there should be more immigration or less immigration?
More immigration, Nyla. I mean, look around us. We all came from, our families all came from some other place at some time. And that is the lifeblood, the strength of this community here, Champaign-Urbana, and this district and our state and our nation. And we should be loud and proud advocates for increased immigration. The people who want to come to this country and to contribute and to do wonderful things, open the door, let them in. Let's make America a place of multiple cultures and multiple voices, and celebrate that.
I've heard you talk a lot about morality as you've been on the campaign trail.
Yes.
Honestly, it's a word we often hear more often in the GOP. Why is that important for you to highlight?
Well, it's important for me because I think, you know, at the end of the day, many of the political decisions that we're making are moral decisions. Budgets are moral documents. They lay out our priorities, and they give to some and not to others. And we are, I think, the extent to which we recognize that the decisions that we make as communities, as a state, as a nation, have moral need to have moral logics to them, the better off we're going to be.
The 13th District is an interesting shape if you look at it on the map, and it covers a wide swath. Do you have a favorite place to visit in the district?
You know, I love Decatur. I love Decatur. I've been spending a lot of time in Decatur over the last couple of months, and the people there are so warm. It's a wonderful community. Especially, I've been spending time in the churches, and they're so welcoming, and so that's my answer, Decatur.
John Ebel is a religion professor at the University of Illinois. He's had a past career in the U.S. military, as he mentioned, serving for 11 years in the Navy as an intelligence officer. He's one of five candidates running for the Democratic primary in the 13th Congressional District. John Ebel, thanks for being with me.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Another candidate for the 13th District is Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan of Springfield. She's worked as a fundraiser for politicians, including our current U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, as well as the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation. Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is an election year where a lot of Democrats are saying they want to run for governor, for attorney general. Last time around in this race, there was just one opponent against Rodney Davis. Why do you want to run against him to represent the 13th District now?
You know, the tipping point for me getting into this race is very personal. It is because I saw Rodney Davis and Donald Trump and all their cronies celebrating in the White House on the day they passed Trump Care out of the House. And that bill would have been, it would have devastated families across the district, across the nation, frankly. But for our family, it was like a knife to the heart, because about 8.5 years ago, my husband and I, who have three children, almost lost our oldest son, Jack, to, of all things, a tick bite. That's what started it. And we landed in the pediatric intensive care unit of St. John's Children's Hospital here in Springfield for 21 days. And after doing surgery on Jack and putting him into a medically induced coma and putting him on a ventilator to keep him alive, we were extremely fortunate, because that medical team saved Jack's life not once or twice, but every minute of every day for a very long time. And what I know to be true is that if we had not had access to good health care, we would have lost our son. And if we had not had good insurance at the time, that would have bankrupted our family. And if they hadn't lifted the caps with the ACA, then our life now would be unrecognizable. So to see people celebrating taking those protections away from people was seemed just cruel and heartless. And I knew that somebody had to get in this race and stand up to Rodney Davis and Donald Trump and fight for health care.
How's your son doing now?
Thank you for asking. He's doing very well.
And as you've said, your top priority, and you've said this in the past, and as you've shared this story, our listeners will realize that you've said your top priority is to not just stabilize, but fix the healthcare system. And there's a couple of steps that you would take in order to do that. Can you outline those for me, please?
Sure. You know, the first thing I want to do is I want to look at the ACA as the first step. And we need to stabilize it. We almost need to triage it and make sure that we don't lose the benefits that we have with it. And then moving forward, I think the next step is to introduce a public option. And, you know, Medicare, Medicaid for all, either one, there are two really good options on the table. And it can open up access and affordable health insurance to across the nation. It would be a great next step.
How do you think we can do a better job of helping rural parts of the 13th District with addiction treatment programs, especially when we're looking at the opioid problem?
Well, the first thing that we have to do is make sure that people have access to care and that we are fully funding all of our community and rural hospitals. And we have to make sure that any expansion that we do includes mental health and addiction treatments. We have to look at this as a comprehensive program. It has to be federal, state, county. It has to be everybody together working because this addiction is taking over.
We've had and heard so much conversation about immigration in this country over the past year. So I think what I want to ask you is just a very simple question. Do you think there should be more immigration or less immigration to this country?
Well, I think, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for immigrants. My grandparents, my great-grandparents all immigrated here. And I want to make sure that we have a fair, practical, and humane path to citizenship.
And what about right now for the Dreamers, as we're hearing conversation about the DREAM Act and DACA? What would you like to see happen there?
I'd like to see a clean bill, and we have to protect them. You know, these individuals came out of the shadows because our government asked them to and said we would protect them, that we would give them a path to citizenship, and so they self-identified. And now we are putting them into a very precarious position. We need to protect them, and we need to keep these very talented, devoted individuals in our nation.
I'm speaking with Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. We've seen high school students all over the country and here in Illinois demanding political change in regards to what they say is common sense gun control laws. Of course, some might say this is because we've seen very little action from lawmakers on that front for years. What do you think should be done at the federal level to prevent mass shootings?
Well, gun violence affects all of our communities, and we need to make sure that we have the right people in the room making these decisions. We can get universal background checks across the board. We need to do that, and we can do that immediately. And we can keep guns out of the hands of violent offenders and domestic abusers and the dangerously mentally ill. These are all things that we can do with the right people in the room. We can keep military-grade weapons out of the hands of people who are not in the military. We can do that. We already do that to some extent, and we need to make sure that we are keeping assault weapons out of the hands of non-military people. And we have got to allow the Center for Disease Control to study gun violence as the public health crisis that it is, because they will help us identify root causes and actionable steps moving forward.
The 13th District is a kind of an interesting shape if you look at it on a map. It goes as far north as Bloomington, east to Urbana, south to Edwardsville, west to the Missouri border. Where's your favorite place to visit in the district?
Well, I love all of it. And I'll tell you what, I've put 25,000 miles on my car since July 5th, getting around the district and doing what the job of the representative is to do, and that is to stand in front of voters and listen to their concerns. And I think there's beautiful spots all over our district. And I can tell you, no matter where I go, whether whether I'm in Edwardsville or Bloomington or in Decatur or all the way over, visiting in Calhoun County, people are concerned about health care, they're concerned about jobs, and they're concerned about education.
Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan is one of five candidates who are running in the Democratic primary for the 13th District. The primary is on March 20th. Thank you for being with me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have for today. You can find the rest of the 21st election coverage at 21stshow.org. On Monday, we'll wrap up our interviews for the 13th District with Angel Sides. And a reminder, the primary is March 20th. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montecelio. Grace Stetson and Fatima Farah are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.